Welcome back, everybody. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Awesome. Today, we're going way back, like way, way back to those early days of Israel, you know, right after the Exodus, right when they're about to enter the Promised Land.
Oh, so Joshua then.
You got it. Joshua chapters 1-5, to be exact.
Okay, cool. What's the source material for this deep dive?
We're going to be using a lecture series by Robert Van Oy.
Okay, Robert Van Oy, got it.
It's called Exodus to Exile. And let me tell you, this isn't just some dry history lesson.
Oh.
It gets right into this really interesting ethical dilemma. You ready for this?
Hit me.
Is it ever okay to deceive someone?
That's a good one.
And the really crazy part is, this question is tied directly to the conquest of Canaan. What do you think?
Well, it's a fascinating period, that's for sure. I mean, think about it. You've got the Israelites. They've been wandering in the desert for 40 years.
Right, 40 years.
And now, under Joshua's leadership, they're finally about to step foot into the Promised Land.
It's a huge moment.
Absolutely. But before the conquest even begins, there are these two really significant events that take place.
Okay, so paint the picture for me. What's happening?
Picture this. The Israelites are camped right by the Jordan River.
Okay, the Jordan. Got it.
But here's the thing. It's springtime, and the Jordan is at flood stage.
Wow, so we're talking raging waters.
Exactly. It must have been incredibly intimidating.
You think? I mean, talk about an obstacle.
Right. But just like at the Red Sea, God intervenes.
He always does, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. The Jordan River miraculously stops flowing, just like that, allowing the Israelites to cross on dry ground.
I get chills every time I read that story.
Oh, it's amazing.
Such a powerful image of God's power.
Oh, absolutely. But it's more than just a spectacle, isn't it?
How do you mean?
Well, think about the crossing of the Red Sea.
Okay.
It was a pivotal moment for Moses. I mean, it solidified his authority as God's chosen leader. And now, here at the Jordan, it seems like God is doing the same thing for Joshua.
That's a great point. It's like a passing of the torch, a confirmation of Joshua's leadership.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got this epic river crossing. What's the second event you mentioned?
Well, right after they cross the Jordan, there's this mass circumcision ceremony at Gilgal.
Wait, circumcision? Why then? Why there? It seems a little out of place after such a triumphant moment.
Right. It might seem strange, but it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it.
Okay, I'm listening. Explain it to me.
Well, remember, circumcision was the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham, right?
Yeah, the mark of belonging to God's people.
Exactly. So after 40 years of, let's be honest, wandering and disobedience in the wilderness.
Yeah, they weren't exactly the best followers during that time.
No, not really. So this mass circumcision, it's like hitting the reset button on their relationship with God.
I like that. A spiritual reboot.
Right. As they enter this new land, they're renewing their commitment to God, reaffirming their identity as his chosen people.
It's like a fresh start. I can see how that would be significant, especially given what they're about to face. But, you know, before we jump into the conquest, there's this story about Rahab, the prostitute living in Jericho.
Ah, Rahab. Now that's where things get really interesting and where that ethical dilemma we talked about comes into play.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more. What happens with Rahab?
So Joshua sends spies into Jericho, right?
To scope things out. Makes sense.
Exactly. And these spies, they end up being sheltered by Rahab.
By Rahab, the prostitute.
The one and only.
Wow. And you have to think, hiding outlaws in a city like Jericho, I mean, that was a huge risk.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're not just talking a slap on the wrist here. You could be put to death for something like that.
So why does she do it? Why risk everything for these Israelite spies?
Because she believes in the God of the Israelites. She's convinced that Yahweh is the true God.
And that's what motivates her to help the spies.
Exactly. It's her faith in action, even though it means putting herself in serious danger.
Wow, talk about a leap of faith.
Right. But here's where things get complicated. To protect the spies, she lies to the king's men.
Oh, so that's the ethical dilemma.
You got it.
I mean, that's a pretty clear violation of the Ten Commandments, right? Thou shalt not bear false witness.
That's exactly the point.
So what does Van Oy say about this? How does he approach this whole question of whether lying is ever okay?
Well, he lays out four different viewpoints, four different ways of looking at it.
Oh, this is getting good.
Yeah.
So what are the four viewpoints?
Okay, so the first one is the most straightforward. Lying is never permissible.
Okay, that's pretty clear cut. No exceptions.
Right. The second view is kind of the opposite. It's called situation ethics. And it basically says there's no objective standard when it comes to lying.
So it all depends on the situation.
Exactly. The only thing that matters is the law of love. If love requires bending the truth, then so be it.
Interesting. So we've got two extremes, never lie, and love trumps all. What about the other two?
Okay, the third view is a bit more nuanced. It says that, yes, lying is generally wrong. But in extreme situations, like when there's a conflict of obligations, protecting life might take priority over telling the truth.
So you're saying sometimes the spirit of the law is more important than rigidly following the letter of the law.
Right. It's about weighing the competing obligations and choosing the lesser of two evils, so to speak. And then there's the fourth view. It gets a little philosophical.
Uh-oh. This sounds complicated.
Yeah, this one basically says lying is always wrong, but then it tries to redefine what lying actually means.
So it's like a loophole.
Kinda. For instance, like, if you leave your lights on to deter burglars, are you technically lying?
I never thought about it that way. But I see what you're saying. It's about deception, but is it really a lie?
Exactly. And Vinoy actually uses some really interesting examples from history to illustrate this point. He talks about this 19th century theologian named Charles Hodge.
Okay, Charles Hodge, got it.
And Hodge argues that sometimes you're simply not obligated to reveal the truth, like, say, a general protecting battle plans or even just something like, you know, leaving the lights on to deter burglars.
Right, that makes sense.
He even uses this example of a mother hiding her child from a murderer.
Would we say she's obligated to tell the truth in that situation?
Absolutely not. You do whatever it takes to protect your child.
Exactly. So Hodge is saying there's a difference between outright lying and simply withholding information or using deception for a greater good. But where does that leave Rahab?
Right. That's the question I keep coming back to. Was she justified in lying to protect the spies?
Well, Hodge doesn't explicitly address Rahab's case in this particular lecture, but based on his logic, you could argue that she was protecting innocent lives.
I mean, the spies hadn't done anything wrong.
Exactly. And the king's men had no right to demand her cooperation. So you could say she was justified in using deception to protect them.
Okay, that's one perspective. But didn't you say there were four? I did. And not all of them are so forgiving of Rahab's actions. Vinoy also presents the view of Walter Kaiser, who takes a much stricter stance.
Oh, so what does Kaiser say?
He condemns all lying, including what Rahab did. No exceptions.
Wow. Okay, so how does he think Rahab should have handled the situation? Just hand over the spies?
Well, he makes a distinction between concealing and lying.
What's the difference?
He believes Rahab could have simply avoided answering the king's men directly, maybe tried to distract them, without actually telling a lie.
That's a tricky line to walk, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I see what he's saying.
He even uses the example of Samuel in the Old Testament.
Oh, right, Samuel. Didn't he hide from King Saul at some point?
Yeah. And he managed to conceal his true purpose from Saul without actually resorting to lying. So Kaiser is saying there are ways to protect yourself or others without compromising the truth.
Okay, but wouldn't that have put the spies in even greater danger? I mean, it seems like Rahab had to act quickly, decisively. She didn't have time for subtle word games.
You're right. It was a high-stakes situation. And honestly, that's the tension that Vinoy wants us to grapple with.
He wants us to put ourselves in Rahab's shoes.
Exactly. He even brings up modern parallels to help us think through this.
Like what?
Well, he talks about Corrie ten Boom. Do you know her story?
Vaguely. Didn't she help Jews escape during World War II?
She did. She hid them in her home, risking her own life to protect them. But she absolutely refused to lie, even when the Nazis came knocking.
Wow, that takes incredible courage and conviction.
Right. But then Vinoy contrasts that with someone like Brother Andrew. Have you heard of him?
I don't think so. Who's he?
He was this incredible guy who smuggled Bibles behind the Iron Curtain, you know, into communist countries.
Wow, that's risky business.
Oh, yeah, super dangerous. But he was much more willing to use deception to achieve his goals. He felt like the importance of getting the word of God into those restricted countries outweighed any moral qualms about lying.
So even within the Christian tradition, there's no easy answer to this ethical dilemma.
Exactly.
It's a case-by-case basis.
It seems so. And Vinoy acknowledges that complexity. He even shares a story about his own wife. Her family hid Jews in their home during the Nazi occupation of Holland.
Wow, so he's got a personal connection to this whole issue.
He does, and he suggests that in such extreme circumstances, maybe deception is justified.
So it's not black and white, it's all shades of gray.
Exactly. It's about weighing the competing obligations, listening to your conscience, and ultimately trusting God to guide you.
Wow. That's a lot to think about. I mean, we're talking about ancient history here, but these questions about truth and deception, they're still so relevant today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, who hasn't faced a situation where they had to choose between telling the truth and protecting someone they love?
Right. I mean, what would W.E. do if we were in Rahab's shoes? Would we risk our own safety to protect others? And if so, where do we draw the line?
Tough questions. And those questions, they're going to become even more important as we delve into the conquest of Canaan itself, because that's where the rubber really hits the road. Mm-hmm. We're talking about war, conquest, displacement. It's going to force us to confront some really challenging aspects of the biblical narrative.
I'm ready for the challenge. But for now, let's just sit with these questions about truth, deception, and what it means to live a life of faith in a world that's not always black and white. Wow. This deep dive into Joshua just keeps getting deeper, doesn't it?
It does. It's amazing how these stories, even the ones we think we know, can still surprise us.
Totally. We've got miracles, moral dilemmas, and now we're about to tackle the conquest of Canaan itself. I have to admit, this part of the Bible has always been a bit tough for me. I mean, the idea of a loving God commanding the Israelites to conquer and displace people, it's just, well, it's hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah, it definitely challenges our modern sensibilities, doesn't it? I mean, warfare back then was understood and practiced so differently than it is today.
Right. Totally different world. But still, even taking that into account, it's still a lot to process.
It is. And Vanoy acknowledges that. He doesn't try to sugarcoat it or offer easy answers. But he does encourage us to approach this part of the text with a bit of humility and careful consideration.
Humility. Okay. I like that. So how do we do that? How do we approach this topic without, you know, shying away from the tough questions?
Well, for starters, it's important to remember that the Canaanites weren't portrayed as innocent bystanders in the biblical narrative. The text describes them as engaging in practices considered abhorrent by the Israelites, like idolatry and child sacrifice.
Right, right. So the conquest is presented as a judgment against their wickedness.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Even within this framework of divine judgment, there are limits. I mean, the Israelites were commanded to completely destroy certain cities, but others were to be treated differently. So it's not like a blanket condemnation of all Canaanites.
That's interesting. There's more nuance to it than I initially realized. It's not just a simple us versus them narrative.
Right. And even when the text talks about destruction, there's debate about what that actually meant. Some scholars believe it refers to wiping out entire populations.
Wow, that's intense.
It is. But other scholars argue it primarily meant destroying religious idols and dismantling the Canaanite religious system, not necessarily killing everyone.
So there's room for interpretation.
Yeah.
Even within the text itself, it just makes this whole thing even more complex.
It does. And that's why it's so important to engage with these texts critically, to consider different viewpoints and interpretations. It's not about finding easy answers, you know, but about wrestling with the complexity of the text and its historical context. And sometimes the questions are more important than the answers.
I think you're right about that. Sometimes just asking the questions is a step in the right direction. But, you know, something that really stood out to me in the source material was the emphasis on fear. I mean, the Canaanites are described as being terrified of the Israelites, like their hearts melt when they hear about the Jordan crossing. It almost seems like God is using fear as a weapon.
That's a great observation. And yeah, fear is definitely a significant factor in the conquest narrative, but I think it's important to understand how fear functioned in ancient warfare.
Okay. Help me understand that. How was fear used differently back then?
Well, battles back then were often won or lost before they even started, you know, based on perceptions of power and strength. A reputation for military prowess could be as effective as a large army. So the fear that the Canaanites felt, it might have been a way for God to demonstrate his power, you know, and pave the way for the Israelites' victory.
It's like psychological warfare. Their fear made them more vulnerable.
Exactly. And it's worth remembering that the Israelites themselves struggled with fear too. Think about how reluctant they were to enter the promised land after those spies came back with a negative report.
Oh yeah, they were terrified of the giants in the land.
Exactly. God had to constantly reassure them, promise them victory. So fear was a factor on both sides of the conflict.
It's a good reminder that these aren't just abstract stories. We're talking about real people dealing with real emotions and challenges, just like we do today.
Absolutely. And that's what makes these stories so relatable, even thousands of years later. We can see ourselves in their struggles and triumphs.
You know, it strikes me that we've talked a lot about the Canaanites and the Israelites, but we haven't really touched on what this all meant for Rahab. What happened to her after she helped the spies?
Oh, that's a great point. Rahab's story doesn't end with that act of courage and deception. In fact, it gets even more remarkable.
Oh, what happens to her? Spill the beans.
When Jericho falls to the Israelites, Rahab and her family are spared. They're actually brought into the Israelite community, given a place among God's chosen people. It's incredible.
Wait, so the prostitute who lied to protect the spies becomes part of the very people she helped? That's a twist. It seems like her faith, her willingness to risk everything for what she believed in, it earned her a place in this new community.
Exactly. It's a reminder that God's grace can extend to anyone, even those who might seem like unlikely candidates. And her story doesn't end there.
There's more.
According to Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, Rahab becomes an ancestor of King David.
No way.
Yes. And ultimately, of Jesus himself.
Wow, I had no idea. Talk about an amazing legacy for someone who started out as a prostitute in a city that was about to be destroyed. It really goes to show that God can use anyone, regardless of their past, to achieve his purposes.
It's a beautiful reminder that God's ways are not our ways. He sees the heart, not just the outward appearance, and he's always looking for those who are willing to trust him, even when it means going against the grain.
Speaking of going against the grain, this whole deep dive into Joshua has definitely challenged some of my preconceived notions. It's made me realize that there's so much more to these stories than I first thought.
I think that's the beauty of engaging with these ancient texts. They challenge us, make us think, invite us to look at our own lives and our own faith in new ways.
Totally agree. And speaking of new ways, let's dive into another pivotal event in Joshua, the crossing of the Jordan River. It's one of those iconic moments in biblical history, right up there with the parting of the Red Sea.
It certainly is. So picture this. The Israelites are camped out on the banks of the Jordan, which, as you recall, was at flood stage. Imagine trying to cross a raging river with an entire nation, men, women, children, livestock. It's a scene that captures both the immense challenge and the unshakable faith of the Israelites.
It's got to be one of those, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Moments in the Bible.
Right. And just like at the Red Sea, God provides a miraculous way forward. But this time, it's not just about the water parting. God gives Joshua very specific instructions.
Okay, I'm all ears. What were the instructions? What did they have to do?
Well, it involved the Ark of the Covenant, you know, that sacred chest that represented God's presence, and the priests were carrying it.
Okay, the Ark, the priests, got it.
And then as soon as their feet touched the water, the flow upstream just stopped, creating this dry path for the Israelites to cross.
Wow, what an image.
Right, it's this powerful visual representation of God's power and faithfulness. But there's another detail that's really interesting. After they cross, Joshua tells the people to set up 12 stones as a monument.
Oh, yeah. I remember that part. One for each of the 12 tribes of Israel.
Exactly. Yeah. Like a physical reminder of what God had done for them. It's like this tangible history lesson.
Yeah. It's like, hey, kids, see these stones?
Yeah.
Let me tell you about the time God stopped the Jordan River so we could walk across on dry land.
Right. A way to keep that memory alive for generations to come. It makes you think about the importance of storytelling, you know, of passing down our faith experiences to the next generation. It's something we can all learn from.
Absolutely. I mean, faith isn't something we just inherit passively. We have to actively engage with it, wrestle with it, and find ways to make it relevant for our own lives, for the lives of our kids and grandkids.
Couldn't have said it better myself. This whole deep dive, it's making me think about my own faith journey in new ways. It's challenging me to dig deeper, to ask the hard questions, to not shy away from the complexities of the Bible.
Me too. It's not about having all the answers, right? It's about embracing the journey, letting the text speak to us in new and unexpected ways. But before we get too philosophical, we need to address another significant event that happens just after the Jordan crossing, the mass circumcision ceremony at Gilgal.
Yes, the circumcision ceremony. That's one that always gets people talking. I mean, after such a triumphant entry into the Promised Land, it seems a bit out of place.
It does, doesn't it? Why would they do that right then and there? And why hadn't they been circumcising their sons during those 40 years in the wilderness? Seems like a strange time to suddenly decide, hey, let's all get circumcised.
Right. It's one of those head-scratching moments in the Bible. And honestly, the source material doesn't give us a definitive answer. But there are some clues we can piece together. Remember, circumcision was the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham, passed down from generation to generation. It was a physical mark of belonging to God's chosen people.
Right, like a badge of honor, a symbol of their identity as God's people.
Exactly. But during those wilderness wanderings, the Israelites were, let's face it, under God's judgment for their disobedience. The source material actually mentions Numbers 14 and Psalm 95, which describe God's anger with the people who refused to enter the Promised Land after those spies brought back a negative report. So maybe, just maybe, circumcision as a symbol of the covenant was put on hold during that time of judgment.
That makes sense. It's like their relationship with God was strained, so the outward sign of that relationship was also suspended. But now, as they finally enter the promised land, it's time for a renewal, a fresh start.
Exactly. It's like hitting the reset button on their relationship with God. They're recommitting themselves to the covenant, reaffirming their identity as his chosen people. And it's not just about the circumcision either. The Israelites also celebrate Passover at Gilgal, which they hadn't been able to do for years because of the uncircumcised men among them. Remember, only circumcised males were allowed to participate in the Passover meal.
Right, right. So it's a double dose of covenant renewal.
Yeah.
Circumcision and Passover. They're marking this new chapter in their history with a powerful reminder of who they are, of where they belong.
And think about the timing. They've just crossed the Jordan. They're about to face powerful enemies in Canaan. They need this spiritual boost, you know, this affirmation of God's presence and protection. It's like a pep talk from God himself. Hey, I'm with you. I haven't forgotten you. And I'm going to help you conquer this land.
It's a powerful image, that's for sure. But even with all this divine intervention, the conquest itself still raises some tough questions for me. It's one thing to cross a river on dry land. It's another thing to go to war and displace people from their homes.
I hear you. It's a complex issue, and it's one we'll be diving into in the next part of our deep dive. We're going to talk about the ethics of the conquest, the complexities, the challenges it presents to our modern understanding of God and his character.
Okay, I'm ready for it. Bring on the tough questions. But for now, let's just take a moment to appreciate what we've learned so far. We've covered miracles, ethical dilemmas, the power of faith, and the complexities of ancient warfare. It's been quite a journey.
It has. And it's amazing how much depth and complexity we can find in these seemingly simple stories, right?
Totally. And that's the beauty of engaging with these texts. Mm-hmm. There's always more to discover, more to learn, more to wrestle with. But hey, let's take a deep breath and get ready to tackle the next part of our deep dive. There's still so much more to explore. All right, so we've crossed the Jordan, we've renewed the covenant, and now we're facing the main event, the conquest of Canaan. And I gotta be honest, I'm still wrestling with this whole idea of a loving God commanding the Israelites to take over the land. I mean, knowing that it involved violence and displacement, it's tough to reconcile with the God I believe in.
I hear you. It's definitely one of the most challenging parts of the biblical narrative. And as Vennoy points out, there's no easy answers here. But he encourages us to look at the conquest through a few different lenses to try to understand it from multiple perspectives.
Okay, I'm all about new perspectives. What kind of lenses are we talking about here? Help me see this differently.
Well, for starters, we need to remember that the Israelites viewed this conquest as a fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. You know, the promise to give his descendants the land of Canaan.
Right, the promised land.
Exactly. And they firmly believed that they were acting on God's direct command. Obedience was paramount to them.
So, for them, it was about fulfilling prophecy and obeying God's will. That makes sense, but it still doesn't fully address the violence.
It doesn't. And that's where understanding the historical context becomes so important. You see, their understanding of warfare was vastly different from ours. In the ancient world, conquering land and displacing people, well, it was sadly a common practice.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't make it right, but it helps to understand the mindset of the time.
Exactly. But it's still a tough pill to swallow. And Vannoy doesn't shy away from that. He acknowledges the tension between God's love and his judgment, especially as it plays out in the conquest narrative.
It's okay to admit that it's complicated, right? I mean, faith isn't about blind acceptance. It's about asking the tough questions, wrestling with those difficult parts of the Bible.
Absolutely. It's about engaging with the text, even the parts that make us uncomfortable, and seeking to understand God's character more fully, even when it seems contradictory.
I think that's what I appreciate about Vannoy's approach. He doesn't give us easy answers, but he encourages us to think critically.
He does. He wants us to wrestle with these texts, to grapple with the implications, and ultimately to come to our own conclusions.
It's a journey, isn't it?
It is. And you know, this whole conversation about the conquest makes Rahab's story all the more remarkable.
How so?
Well, think about it. Here's this Canaanite woman living in a city that's about to be conquered by these people who believe her people are, you know, wicked and deserving of judgment. And yet she chooses to side with the Israelites.
Because of her faith in their God.
Exactly. It's like she sees something different, something beyond the violence and the conquest. She sees a God worthy of her trust, even if it means betraying her own people.
It's incredibly brave. And remember, she and her family are ultimately spared from the destruction of Jericho. They're brought into the Israelite community and become part of God's chosen people. Talk about a turn of events.
It really is. It's a testament to the transformative power of faith, to God's willingness to extend grace even to those who seem like unlikely candidates. It gives me hope. It reminds me that even in the midst of conflict and judgment, God's grace can find a way.
That's a beautiful thought. And, you know, thinking back on this whole deep dive, it's been quite a journey. We've talked about miracles, moral dilemmas, the complexities of ancient warfare, and the incredible faith of this Canaanite woman who dared to trust the God of her enemies. It's amazing how much we can learn from just a few chapters in the book of Joshua.
It is. It really highlights the richness and the complexity of these ancient texts. And honestly, I think the fact that these stories can still spark such lively conversation thousands of years later, that's a testament to their enduring power.
Absolutely. And to all our listeners out there, we hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity too. Don't be afraid to dig deeper, to ask those hard questions, to grapple with those challenging parts of the Bible, because that's where the real growth happens.
That's where faith comes alive. So keep exploring, keep questioning, keep seeking. There's a whole world of wisdom and insight waiting to be discovered in those ancient pages. And until next time, may your own deep dives be filled with wonder and discovery.